Greentree then said he had broken off the talk to show me something. I will show you that his spirit is out of his body. Both your arms are stretched apart, as you still hold his hands. Now try to lower his arms. I tried, but they were as stiff as if he were a wooden image. I felt his muscles, and right down his body, every part of him was like wood. Rigor mortis, a voice shouted, and indeed it was. With all my strength I could not move one arm or the other either up or down. I gave up as I felt that if I exerted too much pressure his arm would break. Then another voice, "We shall bring his spirit back and take him out of trance." Gradually the muscles slackened and I placed him gently down in his seat. In a few minutes Sloane's voice spoke, asking if we had had a good sitting. Sloane is not so tall or muscular as I am, but, on the first chance I got, I asked a man more muscular than I am to stand up, with his arms outstretched, and keep them rigid while I tried to pull them down. I had not the least difficulty in doing so, and my readers can make the experiment for themselves. Evidently, to give me further proof on this occasion, Greentree withdrew Sloane's etheric body further away from his physical body, so that for the time being he was as one dead. In ordinary trance the etheric and the physical must be in closer connection, as there never is this rigidity of muscles. It was an experiment I am glad was not often repeated, as only on one other occasion did I have a similar experience. I shall conclude these nights of instruction in the chapter which follows. Chapter 13 Nights of Instruction, concluded. The wise are instructed by reason, ordinary minds by experience, the stupid by necessity, the brutes by instinct. Cicero. The only other record I shall give of these private sittings is the one dated 24th of January 1924, Miss Miller again acted 125. Is note taker, and I held Sloane's hands, my feet always touching his. At each sitting similar conditions ruled. Sloane sat opposite me, and in about 10 minutes went off into trance. The light was put out, and we waited in the darkness wondering what further we would learn this night. Good evening, Mr. Findlay. Oh, good evening, Greentree, I replied, I recognize your voice. Question, I am glad you have come tonight. Now can you tell me the difference between trance and sleep? Answer, in sleep that is, natural sleep, the sleep the physical body needs, all the functions of the body are at rest except the heart, which keeps on pulsating. That is natural sleep, but the spirit does not always leave the body. In trance we put the spirit slightly aside, but a psychic cord is attached to his body from his spirit body. If that cord should be snapped, dissolution would take place immediately. Before we can speak through him we require to get his spirit out of him, outside altogether, but it is still attached to the body by this cord of life. He is now unconscious and outside his physical body. His spirit at the moment is exactly between his body and you. If nothing untoward happens, he can return to his body just as he left it. If something should go wrong in his present condition, the physical frame suffers. On this occasion you will notice I am speaking to you by means of his vocal organs. I am standing behind him, but am in such close contact with these organs that, just as I move my mouth, his mouth moves. I am in complete control of these organs. The medium knows nothing, he is quite unconscious of anything I do. I am taking temporary use of his body, as the power is not yet strong enough to speak to you by the direct voice. Question, can you hear me quite easily? Answer, yes, I can hear you, but I cannot hear what I say in reply. I am talking behind the medium and I suppose you can hear me. Question, oh yes, I can hear you all right. Can you suggest a means of communication without a medium? Answer, by finding something on earth susceptible to the high vibrations of the spirit world. This, scientists on our side are trying to influence you to accomplish, as it is a thing for you to do, not us. We cannot do more than get our vibrations down to near those of your earth. It is for you 126. To get your vibrations up to meet ours when we come down. Question, how does a medium hear clairaudiently? Answer, By acting on his mind. Question: what will my work be when I reach your world? Answer: you will be eminently suited for research work. Question: when you speak to us, do you lower your vibrations? Answer: certainly, that is what we mean when we say we take on Earth conditions. Question: how is it you lower your vibrations? Answer: it is difficult to explain. It is a condition you get yourself into, which enables you to absorb the ectoplasm from the medium and sitters, and when I do so I feel just as I did when I lived on Earth. Question: how do you hear us speak? Answer: by lowering our vibrations sufficiently to catch the atmospheric vibrations of your voice. I must go now. Good night. After a few minutes a new voice spoke. Greentree has to go, he has other work to do, but he has asked me to speak to you in case you have anything more to say. Question: thank you for coming. You might tell me how it is you are able to speak to me. Greentree and Gallacre and others have told me, but the more information I get the better I can understand your methods. So far everything I have been told by different voices harmonizes and agrees. You go on talking. You may say something I have not heard before. Answer: I feel as if I were just back on Earth again. This is just as interesting to me as it would be for you to come over here to our side and see how this is worked. You would be fascinated seeing all that takes place before a spirit voice can vibrate your atmosphere. First we are told by White a Feather, or someone else, when a seance is to take place, he is always about the medium and knows everything he does, and hears when he arranges a seance. Then we all come. White a Feather gets the spirit body out of the medium's body, the chemist and his assistants come with their preparations, and Gallacre comes to manage the trumpets. Not that the trumpets are always necessary, you have often heard us speak without them. They just magnify 127. The voice and enable us to throw it more easily to the person we wish to speak to. Greentree takes charge and tells the spirits present how and when to speak. It is very interesting watching all the arrangements being made on this side, the chemist linking the medium and sitters, and drawing power from them. Until all these preparations are completed, no voice can be produced that you could hear. The larger end of the megaphone or trumpet is also used to place the materialized mouth and tongue in, as it gives the spirit speaking something to rest them on. Then we speak, pointing the smaller end to the person addressed. Question: is Gallacre here tonight? I want to ask him something. Answer: White a Feather interposed, no, Gallacre is busy at other work. He cannot come tonight. He told me you were coming, me tells them when to come, that's my work. Me look after my medium's spirit. Away people, who will do you no good. When you come as an earnest inquirer you will find us ready to help you. This was addressed to some Aetherians present. I bound here won't allow bad spirits to come here. Me can get right into medium's body, but no one else can. Me manage this after years of practice. It is impossible in a book to convey to the reader the different tones and personalities of the speakers. White a Feather is recognized at once by his voice, his personality and his speech. Whenever he speaks you want to laugh. He is like the clown at a circus. Sometimes he sulks, sometimes he is, figuratively speaking, as black as thunder, only to brighten later and become, by a little flattery, all sunshine. By his quaint remarks and sallies he can keep us laughing for minutes on end. He butts in and twits the Aetherian speaking, or makes some remark about a sitter altogether a very amusing and interesting personality, but one by no means highly developed. Likewise with all the other regular speakers, they are easily recognized, each has his own characteristics and personality which the darkness of the seance room cannot hide. To continue the conversation interrupted by White a Feather. Question: do you keep records of what takes place? Answer: yes, of course we do, we are not encyclopedic. Question: how is the trumpet moved? Answer: when the power is strong enough the spirit's 128 hand is sufficiently materialized to enable him to hold it, but on other occasions by psychic rods. A pause, Someone near you is very anxious to speak. Just wait and don't ask any more questions. Then I received two quick taps on my right shoulder, and I knew at once my father was beside me because he was the only person who ever tapped my shoulder like that. It was a familiar action peculiar to him, as he would slip up to a friend and give the back of his shoulder two quick taps with his fingers. Then he spoke to me, and the rest of the sitting was taken up speaking to him and other friends who were present. Huxley, to whom I have already referred, also spoke, tracing matter and life from early beginnings, through the physical, into the etheric world. Evolution, he concluded, is still my great theme, the thing I am constantly thinking about. Evolution is the key to the universe. Evolution never ends. We are always progressing, progressing, but we retain our individuality. It helps to explain the mystery of existence. I have done my best in these last three chapters to give an outline of the methods I employed to get information relating to the other world about us, and to find how its inhabitants were able to communicate their thoughts to Earth. These private sittings were very impressive, and did as much as anything to convince me of the reality of the other world. Sitting face to face with Sloane, and, when a direct voice was speaking, pressing forward to make certain the voice was not his, confirmed the conclusions I had previously formed, and these, as I have already stated, were not arrived at hastily. I felt that I had now a double check on all I had previously experienced. I had confirmed the medium's honesty, the supernormal nature of the phenomena, the reality of another world in close proximity to our own, and lastly the continuity of life, which I found had only passed beyond our knowledge owing to its having discarded the physical garment which appealed to our senses. Besides this, I had been told something of the life and work in the etheric world, and of their methods of establishing communication with this earth. Truly these nights of instruction were not to be forgotten. 129. Chapter 14 ADD to your faith, knowledge. Ignorance is the curse of God, knowledge is a wing wherewith we fly to heaven. Shakespeare. The foregoing chapters contain information which has seldom been conveyed between two different orders of intelligence in the same clear and concise way. Doubtless we were not ready to receive it, and had it come sooner, it would not have been understood. Today the position is different, as a younger generation is now able to think of the ether and its waves, and of matter composed of atoms and electrons. The human mind has thus advanced sufficiently to be able to grasp the fact that nothing is solid as we understand the word, and that everything we see and touch is composed of that substance called ether, which only when vibrating at a certain frequency appeals to our senses. The vast majority of the vibrations of the ether never affect us, though we know by means of instruments that they exist and the most likely have always existed. Is it inconceivable that there are other beings who can sense what we are incapable of sensing, or is the sum total of intelligence confined to what we call our humanity? Is there no other life capable of appreciating ether waves, either below or above our limited capacity? Surely to adopt this view reveals a very limited outlook. We know how primitive man was able to appreciate only his own immediate surroundings, and how he regarded the stars as lights placed in the firmament for his special benefit. His mind could not have grasped the discoveries of Copernicus. Had Bacon in 1623, in his De Augmentis Scientiarum, discoursed on the vibratory activity of matter, his work might have died at birth. The human mind in his day could hardly comprehend the majesty and greatness of the physical universe, and the universe of ether could only be appreciated when first of all the physical universe was properly understood. This mental development took 300 years, and today we find just the same difficulty in harmonizing ourselves with this next forward step, as did our forefathers in adjusting their minds to the astronomy of Copernicus and Galileo, and, in later years, to the biology of Darwin. 130. Each forward step takes time. The great minds take the first step, often amid jeers, but by and by the multitude follows. Our children will be able to appreciate the etheric universe in a way many of the older generation never will, because to them an etheric world beyond the physical will be comprehensible as it will never be to their parents and grandparents, It required at least 100 years before the discoveries of Galileo and Copernicus gained a general acceptance among educated people. Then, just as now, appearances were different from reality. It took 50 years and more, after Darwin, before most of the educated were able to accept the fact that our Earth, and its inhabitants, are the outcome of a slow but steady evolution and not an instantaneous creation. All new discoveries have had to meet with uncompromising opposition. History is full of the fact that humanity has invariably persecuted, and sometimes murdered, its greatest thinkers, and afterwards worshipped at their graves. The human mind is so constituted that new ideas penetrate slowly, and are only accepted after long and fierce discussion. No doubt this conservatism is for the best, as, if it were otherwise, there would be no stability, whereas, though truth always wins through in the end, much chaff is discarded in the winnowing. Every radical change in science, religion, or philosophy has only won its way to acceptance by ultimately appealing to the reason of mankind, and psychic discoveries will be no exception. We must therefore expect that it will take time before this new knowledge becomes part of the generally accepted truths of the world, and this will only come about by more and more earnest seekers investigating the phenomena, and year by year accumulating further evidence which in the end will remove all doubt. What, therefore, must be the attitude of all those who, putting aside prejudice, set their faces earnestly towards the truth? What should be my attitude under the circumstances so far related in this book? Should I keep silent, or tell the world of my discoveries, ignoring its jeers and scoffs? Each one of us is but the trustee of knowledge entrusted to him, and to hold back for fear of ridicule would be but cowardice. 131. I tell only what I have been told, and this book is not the product of my imagination. I am not a missionary trying to change beliefs long held. I am only relating something I have heard and seen, which will make more intelligible those beliefs held sacred by the great majority of mankind. If, in the process of assimilating further knowledge of the unseen, certain beliefs now held fundamental are found to be but symbols of a greater truth lying further back, is this not just a repetition of what has occurred in the past? Knowledge is like a tree of slow growth. Year after year it sheds its leaves which have been the means of its nourishment. But still the tree remains, slowly but surely adding to its stature and girth. So today certain old beliefs, which helped mankind onwards in his reaching out after God and the unseen, must be discarded so that place may be found for those of newer and fresher growth, but the real and enduring fabric will always remain. The knowledge gained by this new science of psychics only confirms and deepens the great and universal truths proclaimed by religion and philosophy. We find in our researches an all-directing mind, fashioning and molding the universe, one great stupendous plan, far beyond the comprehension of anyone in this world and of most in the next. We find that as we sow here we shall reap hereafter, that we are making our next life in this, that life persists and is indestructible, that memory, personality and character are our real selves, and that it is not they but only their physical covering that decays at death. Further, we find that we are surrounded by an unseen multitude who, under certain conditions, can hold converse with us from time to time. Have not the fundamental and essential truths of religion received confirmation by this new revelation? And are we more likely to become irreligious by its acceptance? When we look round at the so-called religious world of thought today, is there not an instinctive feeling, among even the most orthodox, that things are out of gear? Consider the sects, the dissensions and the quibblings on the one hand, and the utter indifference on the other, and we have the results of orthodox religion in a nutshell. If we take Britain alone as an example, we have just become sufficiently educated to make the majority of us wonder what is truth. In the old days of ignorance there, 132, was no difficulty in accepting truth, because truth for the multitude was what was told them by the church. That was during the Dark Ages, but the printing press had its effect, and a few hundred years ago some were sufficiently intelligent to doubt the authority of this church. They threw it over, and pinned their faith on what was considered an infallible book instead of on an infallible church. Knowledge progressed. The infallible book began to be doubted, and then more doubted, and, in consequence, since the Reformation, there has been dissension everywhere among the Protestant section of the community because they had nothing solid on which to base their beliefs. The Roman Catholic Church alone has managed to pursue its even way, without at least open disruption, but the history of Protestantism reminds one of an iceberg, forever breaking up. Each section, of course, considered itself right and the rest all wrong, and each section hid its own texts to support its contentions. Today, nearly a third of the way through the 20th century, we find the same form of church service, the same rigmarole of words used which satisfied our ignorant forefathers, but they are far from satisfying the thinking section of the population. In consequence, church congregations are becoming smaller, because people have little sympathy with its teaching. Other people, however, indifferent to the essential truths which all religions have proclaimed? By no means. As many people today are more interested and fully alive to the essential truths of religion than ever before, and the church has lost a great opportunity by retaining its impossible creeds, and thus forcing from it the thinking section of the population. In the Church of England prayer book there is set down to be read or sung, on certain feast days and Sundays, the Creed of Saint Athanasius, which tells us, among other things, that if we do not believe the incomprehensible we cannot be saved, and without doubt we shall perish everlastingly. This cruel creed sets out the Christian faith. It has never been repudiated or withdrawn. In fact, it is the basis of Protestant and Roman Catholic Christianity, or, as the prayer book says, it is the confession of Christian faith. How can any intelligent man or woman read this creed and say honestly that this jumble of meaningless words constitutes his or her faith, and yet it is glibly sung? 133. Or read throughout England on certain appointed Sundays. The utter lack of authority, and basis for belief in Protestant Christianity, finds ample confirmation in the diverse opinions held with regard to transubstantiation. The Bishop of Birmingham, Morning Post, 23 July 1931 accuses the Archbishop of Canterbury of countenancing the belief that a priest, by the act of consecration, can cause Christ to come and dwell within the bread and wine of Holy Communion, and that the belief that a spiritual presence can be made to inhere in a piece of bread by consecration is false. This is only an example of what has been happening off and for the last 1,900 years. If it was not a discussion or an argument about transubstantiation, or the Trinity, it was a quarrel over the authenticity of some passage in Scripture. Christianity, since its foundation, has been the cause of one discussion and argument after another, relating either to creeds or forms and ceremonies on the one hand, or the meaning and interpretation of certain portions of Scripture on the other. Christianity has been like a ship at sea, forever seeking a port and never finding one, because it has no sound and solid foundation for its assertions. They have been dependent on the pronouncement of some church authority, or some passage in Scripture, and these have received different interpretations in different ages. Consequently, the Christianity of today is as unlike as possible the Christianity of the first century. These opinions and interpretations have caused an untold number of divergent views throughout Christendom, and been the cause of the hundreds of sects which have formed the Christian Church since its foundation. Small wonder that only a small section of the community attends divine service, because the leaders themselves cannot agree as to what is truth, and so their followers, losing heart, get fewer and fewer. The number of those attending spiritualist services, on the other hand, is yearly increasing. What ray of hope is held out to those around an open grave? This is what the mourners are told: we shall not sleep, but we shall all be changed, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. Now to be changed is the last thing any one of us wants. Everyone wants to be himself or herself, and retain his or her own individuality and personality, and this is just what we shall do in a body similar to our earth body. What comfort can any quotation bring to the sorrowing mourners? And yet at every Christian funeral the clergy read this obsolete burial service, or, if dissenters, repeat similar words, and consign the dead to the grave until the great resurrection. This consigning of the dead to the grave until some future resurrection day has been going on now since the commencement of Christianity. It went on before Christianity was thought of, and, if the clergy are right, our graveyards must be full of sleeping bodies awaiting the great roll call. In the past the people have accepted this old Egyptian belief in a bodily resurrection because they knew no better, but sooner or later, owing to our increased knowledge, the truth must become known. Anyone who doubts the foregoing view of the Church's opinion on the subject, will find it confirmed by reading over the well-known hymns which are sung at so many funerals, "Now the laborer's task is o'er and on the resurrection morning." We cannot expect the clergy to repudiate the beliefs from which they earned their livelihood, and it now rests with spiritualists to affirm that the essential truths of religion can be believed, not as an act of faith, but as scientific facts. I am told, however, that all that is new can be read into the old creeds, and that these dead bones can be made to live again by pouring the oil of the new revelation upon them. That may satisfy some, but it does not satisfy many who are now thinking for themselves, and passing over with indifference, the pronouncements of the Church. These old writings are interesting relics of a bygone age, but why ponder over the gropings of our ignorant ancestors after truth when we have before us these things they were seeking after? What then is our position today? We now know that our survival and our entering into the etheric world is not conditioned by any kind of belief. It is a natural process, just as natural as birth. It takes place, not at some far distant future date, but at death. It does not matter in the least whether one believes in events recorded in the Bible or not. 135. Or whether one is a believer, on the one hand, that heaven is a new Jerusalem with its streets paved with gold, or, on the other hand, that there is no such thing as survival and that the grave is our end. All these beliefs mean nothing so far as survival is concerned, as the most ignorant believer, and the most pronounced atheist, will reach the etheric world when the time comes for his etheric body to leave his physical body. There is no separate place, heaven for the believers or hell for the unbelievers. But ignorance is not bliss, and it breeds false imaginings. The more you know of the country you are going to, and the means of entry, the more at home you will feel in it when you arrive there. We shall be much more in harmony with our surroundings if we prepare ourselves correctly in advance, though it is unwise to give too much thought to it. I am writing with some authority, as I have had one or two interesting experiences. A clergyman who had died told me that he could make no progress until the last of his congregation had arrived from this world. I asked him why, and he said that the reason was because he had preached to them Orthodox Christianity, namely, the forgiveness of sins through the belief in Christ's death on the cross, and the punishment of all who had not this belief. He was waiting to tell each one of his congregation, as they came over, that he was wrong, and that he had given them an entirely wrong impression of the afterlife. I was once told that all young children who had passed into the etheric world as infants, without any knowledge of this earth's religious dogmas and creeds, grew up quite ignorant of these, as these earth-made beliefs meant nothing to the inhabitant of that world. Those passing over, holding such beliefs, are taught to see their error, and those who have not preached them very quickly forget them in their new surroundings. Those, however, responsible for preaching and teaching error may have to endure mental remorse until they have forgotten their mistake. Another experience I had was equally interesting, and shows how wide is the divergence of thought, wherever it be. The group, which was working along with me on the other side, said they were going to bring to speak to me a Plymouth brother, who on earth had his ideas so fixed that he could not get rid of them in his new surroundings. 136. This man, who I found out afterwards had been a prominent Plymouth brother in Glasgow, being noted for his very narrow and bigoted views, and who had recently died, spoke much as he must have spoken on earth on many occasions. talk about a hardened sinner. He was certainly the most hardened believer that I have ever experienced. From the other side, he discoursed to me about the wickedness of everybody except himself.